Hello, and welcome to episode 96 of the Movie Brats podcast. I am Carter, and joining me, as always, is Jonathan. And we are coming very tardy with our top 10 of 2023, just a week after the Oscars were recording this. So we're not so tardy as to be completely irrelevant, but we're borderline that. I know, Jonathan, you've wanted to do this for quite some time, so are you ready to count down our top 10 of 2023?
Yes, and we should point out that unless one lives in New York City or Los Angeles, there are multiple films that get released at the very end of a calendar year, but don't open wider until February, even March, closer to the Oscars, such as The Taste of Things, Perfect Days, and some of them are actually considered 2024 releases, but there's some that open maybe 1 week in one of those big cities last year. So I haven't had the opportunity to actually see some of the major ones. I mean, a lot of people didn't see The Zone of Interest until like January or February.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't see Perfect Days until 2 weeks ago. So one of the best reviewed movies of 2023 was very much a 2024 movie in my experience.
You know, what's the biggest gap between a film coming out somewhere and getting an Oscar nomination?
I don't.
It's about 20 years because Limelight came out in like 1950. And then Chaplin got kicked out of the country, basically, and he refused to come back except one time to get an honorary Oscar. And he was nominated for best score for Limelight like 20 plus years after it originally came out.
Wow.
Because it didn't actually get a proper theatrical release. Yeah.
Well, we're not that late then.
No, no.
If we were doing this in 2030, maybe we could compete. So I think we're going to start off with Jonathan's top 10 because we have quite a bit of overlap. And then I will fill in some of my top 10 at the very end of the episode. So, Jonathan, why don't you get us kicked off with your number 10 movie of 2023?
Yes. So a number of films in my top 10, people criticize that there are films that are too long these days. And three of my top 10 are 3 hours or longer. And my number 10 film is the longest, right at exactly 4 hours.
Wow.
Is now 94-year-old Frederick Wiseman's Menus, Plaisir, Tres, Trois, Quatre, or however you say it. Of note, it is actually on PBS streaming for free, and it's actually going to air in total without commercial interruption in about a week from now. Look at your local listings. Frederick Wiseman, legendary director. It's interesting. He's been making films just about one every year, 2 years, since 1967. And that is 1 year longer than this restaurant that he's documenting has maintained a 3-star Michelin rating. His first film, Titicoc Follies, was 67. They had their first rating. They achieved that rating in 1968. And this film, it's almost denigrating to call it food porn, but in extreme long takes and minute detail, you see every aspect you can conceive of how one of the first rate restaurants in the world is run. You see food being prepared, multiple scenes of different food being prepared. You see meetings about what's going to be on the menu. You see the farmers and the restaurant workers going to the farm. You see long scenes of people talking about different cheeses. And I found it utterly engrossing, and it is just so enjoyable watching a master filmmaker making a film as good as he's ever made, which is something that we'll come back to in other films on my list of people that are older that are making films as good as they've ever made. I know you're not really as much into watching documentaries, and maybe the idea of watching a 4-hour documentary is not something you'll make yourself ever do, but it's a wonderful film.
And he's very much a fly on the wall kind of documentary filmmaker, right?
Yes, he's quipped. Well, I like to think I have a little bit more sense than a fly, but the kind of conceit of his documentary, that's not really the right word, but kind of the guidelines he's had since his very first film, is that there's no narration, there's no direct interviews, there's no added music unless there's just music in the scene where he's filming, and there's no title cards except for the opening and closing credits. So
Oh, wow.
you're thrown into different institutions. Most of his films for the longest time were in America somewhere. I mean, you never knew what he was going to do. Film a mental institution, prison, his first film, Tickler Follies, a high school, a boxing gym in Texas, a meatpacking plant, a zoo in Florida. But in the last 20 years or so, I mean, more than that, but he's gone over to France because he lives quite a bit of the time in France. He's done one about the National Gallery Museum in London. He's
Oh, wow.
kind of gone all different places, but I highly recommend it. I've also heard, I don't know if it is currently, but it should be on Canopy, as are all of his films. He's getting close to, it's funny that all right around the same time, Woody Allen, Clint Eastwood, and Wiseman all started right around, like, within a 3 or 4 year period, and they've all had about a film every year or two. So Wiseman's about 45 films in. So highly recommend it. It may seem like a chore, and it's a long movie, but it's fantastic. So however
Menu
you pronounce it.
plaisir les
Yeah.
trois gras.
Yes.
If you type in Frederick Wiseman, one of the Google things people also ask is, what is the 4-hour food movie? So that is what that is. So yeah,
Yes.
kicking us off with a very, very Jonathan pick for number 10.
Right.
So you're number nine.
Yes, is drastically shorter. It's the shortest film on my list. It's actually a short. It's Wes Anderson's The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar, which I think is about 38 minutes. It's a little under.
Oscar-winning short film.
Yes, Oscar winner Wes Anderson now. He is so prolific that he wasn't at the ceremony except the award in person because he's shooting a new film. I think that this might be my favorite Wes Anderson film now. For a while, it was Fantastic Mr. Fox, and the connection those films have is that they're both based on the writing of Roald Dahl, who I grew up loving, writer of such works as Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, James and the Giant Peach, and Matilda. And he had these four shorts that premiered one day after each other, and they're all four worth watching. The other three are right around 20 minutes, about half the length. But I think Henry Sugar is, I mean, yes, it's Anderson, so it's exquisitely, obsessively, anally made in the way it's shot and its design. But I feel like there's a real moving quality. It creeps up on you by the end of that short. And I just think that it's so lovely, and it's just an auteur at the absolute height of what they do. And I know Wes Anderson isn't for everyone, but perhaps some people that get in the sense that he's indulgent, like 38 minutes might be a good way to experience him.
It's like a taster
Not.
menu of Wes Anderson.
Yes, he is one of the few major directors working these days that has never made a film over 2 hours. Life Aquatic is 1 hour and 59 minutes, I think. So just under. But I thought, you saw that one, but not the other three, correct?
That's right. I had my Netflix subscription expiring and made sure to watch that one before it expired. And I really loved it. I mean, I watched it very much at your recommendation. You had mentioned that it was one of your favorites of the year. And as a real Roald Dahl expert, I know you had some misgivings about Wonka and that this one very much lived to up to what you think an adaptation of Roald Dahl's work should aspire to be. It's the first time that Anderson has worked with Benedict Cumberbatch, is that correct?
Yeah, well, I think so. Sometimes it's like you look at the list and like, oh, like
Yeah,
here's the
he was in
40
it for
people.
30 seconds in
I
another
know.
movie.
Like I heard, did you ever hear that Angelica Houston, who was in The Royal Tenenbaums and a few others, that he credited her as like a mute dog in Isle of Dogs, even though she like didn't actually like stand in front of a
Participate.
microphone. I know. You had Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio with Cate Blanchett voicing a monkey, only making monkey noises, but she actually did make the monkey noises. But I do think that Wes Anderson is a director that I always like his movies, some more than others, but all of his movies are comedies
Yeah, they're
and
all
they're
very
funny.
funny. He's
Yeah,
very
yeah.
sharp.
Yeah, Henry Sugar is not as like guffaw actually laughing out loud, but it's so clever and you're just so swept up. And I think I really would, if I ever taught a class on film adaptations, it would be really a good one because it's almost the way that Wiseman's obsessive about showing detail and long scenes. Anderson is obsessively being faithful to the text to the point where characters literally turn to the screen and say, "I said," or "he said."
Yeah,
And
direct address, yeah.
yes, and it's interesting that the shorts they're going to be, I've heard, released as an anthology film. I don't really know like what the purpose of that is because like they're just on Netflix and you could watch them together. But I'm very obsessive like Anderson in some ways, but I always like to say I've seen a certain film or a certain director's films in a theater in their original release. So can you, Carter, justify? I saw it on Netflix, but then I saw it with the live action Oscar shorts. I feel like if you see it within 6 months of its original release, it counts as seeing it in quote its original release.
Yeah, I think you can count that. I think that'd be very fair. I don't think you're cheating.
I would have seen it basically played in hardly any theaters. It was actually in New
Yeah.
York right before I got there. I saw, by the way, the Wiseman film at the New York Film Festival, all 4 hours, no intermission, did not miss a second. And I got a selfie with Frederick Wiseman, and it was funny
Wow.
because afterwards I said, I was very nice. I was like, "Sir, do you mind if I take a picture with you?" And he said, "Yeah, just hurry up." And then in my head, I was thinking, I just sat through a 4 hour movie by you.
I
You
gave you
want me
my
to,
time. You can give me some of
yes,
yours.
yeah. But he was nice, and have you ever seen any of his movies?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, you should at least watch Tittlecock Follies because that's like a landmark.
Yes, it's one I've very much heard of.
Yeah, and under 90 minutes.
Well, there you go.
Yes.
But back to Henry Sugar. Really great cast, in addition to Benedict Cumberbatch, Ralph Fiennes plays Roald Dahl, basically,
Yes.
right? That's sort of like the framing device of the whole story.
And
And
like
then
Anderson, usually it's like a story within a story within a story, maybe within a story. It's like you have
yeah.
all these levels. It's like Russian dolls of
So that's
storytelling.
very much how Grand Budapest Hotel was, from what I remember, where it starts with
Yes.
like it is a book and then it sort of becomes a story within a story.
And his feature film last year, Asteroid City, also has the idea of like
Yes.
different levels of like storytelling. Like you have a theater production, you have, a TV show. It's like you're having these different levels of art and reality.
Yeah, I mean, so he's very, very interested in that idea, as we can tell, especially recently. And yeah, great performances by Dev Patel and Richard Ayoade as a pair of doctors. This is a very funny movie. It's probably one of the funniest movies I saw last year. And like you said, it's probably a good taster of Wes Anderson for people who think he's maybe a little too stylistic, a little too twee, not enough sort of human emotion, which I've always thought is kind of an unfair criticism. And it's more of the sort of idea of what people think Wes Anderson movies are rather than what they really are. Because usually there is quite a bit of heart in at least a lot of them, like Royal Tenenbaums,
And
Darjeeling Limited.
like Budapest Hotel has a melancholy to it.
Yes, very much
There's
so.
like even though it's like this fictional fantasy world in some ways, there's also this sense of like a war and loss and Henry Sugar. So like by the time you get to the end of it, it's like 38 minutes or something. You just it's so fulfilling and it's just like so note perfect. Yeah. So I put a short on my top 10, but why not? That's why
Yeah.
I. And I'm
So
happy he
you're
won.
number eight.
Yes, is the first of the Best Picture nominees. I have four of them, and my top 10 is The Zone of Interest, the film by Jonathan Glazer, his first feature film he had done in 10 years. I'm a
Yes.
huge fan of his. I think Under the Skin is like top five of the 2010s, and I was.
Very unsettling sci-fi movie.
Yes, and speaking of unsettling, this movie is one where you don't hardly see anything violent or graphic, but it's so unnerving because the film focuses on a Nazi commandant and his family living right next to Auschwitz. And in a weird way, I can connect all these movies like Wiseman. It's like in very matter-of-fact detail, just very exacting, precise detail, you're seeing their day-to-day life, like Wiseman shoots the food. And it's just a really disturbing movie where you don't even really see anything outright disturbing or graphic on the screen, but you know what's happening right over the wall. And I was very happy that the film won Best Sound because it's a subtle use of sound. I mean, Oppenheimer, I would have been happy if it won too because it's such an
That's what I
impressive
was
feat.
expecting to win because Oppenheimer is also an extremely
Loud.
sound-based movie, very loud, but also like the big scene in it is the explosion of the atomic bomb, which is played out virtually in silence, which I thought was a very interesting choice because
Yes.
as much as a consideration of what you hear in sound design, what you don't hear is also equally as important.
I wonder if there's any backlash in the sound department of the Oscars in the wing because I saw a CBS Sunday Morning story last Sunday where they talked about how a sizable percentage of Americans watch everything with closed captioning these days, and they went through some of the reasons, and one reason that they noted was Christopher Nolan, just him, that his movies have such one could say artistic sound design in that you can't understand what the character's saying at all some of the time.
That's basically like the point of Tenet is don't pay attention to what the characters are saying. It doesn't matter.
Yes, but The Zone of Interest, I think, is such a powerful movie and it's a thought-provoking one. And I got to see it at the along with the Wiseman film. I saw it at the New York Film Festival. I had a literal front row seat. I was right in the middle of the very front row in Alice Tully Hall. So that was overwhelming in a way, even though,
I
like I
bet.
said, you don't really see anything. But the film opens with this blackness for like probably 2 minutes at least. And it's like, I think it's almost like cluing the audience in. It's like preparing them for that. Like you're really not going to see anything, but it's just there's this sense of that it's, you know, what's there, what's there. But yeah, I think Jonathan Glazer is this only cements him as one of the most significant filmmakers working in the world of cinema today. It won also the Oscar. It was, you know, a shoo-in to win best international feature film. It was nominated for Best Picture, Best Director. Yeah, I thought this was a great film. My mom went to see it while we were in Florida. She had saw it a few days after the Oscars, caught up with it. And we say this about every single film, but really not even so much for the visuals, but for the sound. You really want to see it in the theater. If it's still playing anywhere near you, and it actually is playing in some theaters still, at least watch it if you have the opportunity with surround sound somewhere, because it's a really significant aspect of the film. So The Zone of Interest is number 8 for me.
I mean, it's in a lot of ways like a pretty confrontational kind of movie, in regard to, I mean, how it treats its audience in some ways, because the sound design is very kind of not intrusive necessarily, but it's very thought, I mean, thought-provoking is an interesting way to describe sound, but it makes you aware of, in some ways, the sort of artifice of the medium of cinema in some ways. And it does that also with the visuals, where you'll get these sort of primary colors of red and stuff like that. So it's a hard movie for me to imagine seeing at home. So I'm very glad I got to see it in the theater with like a lot of people. It was a pretty full auditorium when I got to see it, and it's a very quiet movie, so you can hear the sort of people you're with and sort of think about how other audience members are experiencing it. So it was a cool movie to see with a group of people. Yeah,
It's
definitely
one
one of
that.
the most challenging, widely distributed movies I've seen it in some time. And it's one where I really think that being nominated for Oscars got it a lot more visibility than it otherwise would have had, which is one thing where the Oscars can be very good for movies in that sort of way.
We are going to do our most anticipated films a third of the way through the year. No, but we're going to do. But I was the one last year. Well, I mean, 2023, where I said Zone of Interest was like in my top three most anticipated. I was like, look out for this movie. And I was right. I
Yeah,
was,
you were.
yeah. I mean, he hadn't had a film in 10 years, a feature film at least. So I highly recommend. He only has four films since 2000 in 23 years, now 24 years. He's only had four feature films, but Sexy Beast, Birth, Under the Skin, and now The Zone of Interest. I recommend all of them, but really recommend seeing Zone of Interest in a theater if you can.
Running
So,
short on time on that one. But yeah, I'm very
yeah.
interested to see where he goes next, because it seems like he is very interested in pushing the medium forward. And challenging audiences in different sorts of ways. And whenever people ask actors what director they'd most like to work with, Jonathan Glazer is one you hear a lot, which is interesting because he doesn't really work with a lot of high profile actors, at least in supporting roles. Like Scarlett Johansson was the star in Under the Skin, and there really
Well,
wasn't anyone else besides her that
yeah.
was a big name, right?
Nicole Kidman's in
Well, I
Birth,
know,
and
yeah, but besides her, there aren't a lot of like
oh
big name
yeah,
actors, right?
no,
So usually
and
there's a sort of like headline actor and then supporting faces you've really never seen before.
Birth had Lauren Bacall and Anne
Okay.
Heche. You haven't seen his movie, so hush.
I've seen the
But
last two. That's what was my
okay,
experience of them.
but yeah, Under the Skin basically was Scarlett Johansson and no one else famous,
Yeah,
and
and a lot of like non-actors.
yeah, Sandra Hüller is in two of the Best Picture
Yes.
nominees, and she is could have done one of the things that happens every so often of got not getting nominated for lead actress and supporting.
The last one who did that was Scarlett Johansson, right?
I think so, including
Marriage
for a
Story.
Nazi movie.
Yeah, exactly. Little bits of connections everywhere if you look for them. But yeah, 2023 was very much the year of Sandra Hüller, and I would have liked to have seen her nominated for supporting actress for that role.
Well, should I go on to my number seven, which people can watch right away,
Yes.
along with Henry Sugar if they have Netflix? I have two
Ooh.
Netflix films. It's Todd Haynes' May December,
Here we go. We're
which
getting some
is,
crossover for me now.
oh, where did you place it in your top
Number
10?
six.
Very close. Yes.
Yeah.
I am I've seen all of Todd Haynes. I have to feature narrative theatrical films. So I've not seen Mildred Pierce. I have not seen, which you very much like, the Velvet Underground documentary. That's I missed that
Yes.
one. But I very much like this movie. I went to Atlanta to see it in the theater. There were two major directors last year that had films that I missed their previous one because they came out during the pandemic, or I would have had to travel 2 hours to see them. I didn't see David Fincher's Mank, and so I saw The Killer last year. I didn't see the Underground. Velvet Underground. So I went to Atlanta to see May December.
Yes.
It stars Natalie Portman, Julianne Moore, and to my eyes, a newcomer. He had been acting for a while as a young actor, but Charles Melton, who
Yes,
I
I
really
think.
think deserved a supporting actor nomination. I
Well,
would
yeah,
have
this movie was totally shut out at the Oscars, right?
no got a screenplay
Oh, screenplay,
nomination.
that's right, yeah.
Yes, but I
By
think
fellow
that the
Tisch
week.
graduate, from what I
Oh.
remember. Yeah,
It one of many couples nominated both at the Oscars. There was Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig. Margot Robbie and her husband were both nominated.
Justine
The
Triet and her husband.
yes, the did you know the guy who did Napoleon Dynamite and his wife had a animated short nominated? They were both nominated.
I did not
There was like
realize.
six couples nominated this past Oscars, but yes, May December is this darkly funny melodrama about a woman that committed a crime, having a sexual relationship with a very young adolescent boy when he was in a grade school student, and she went to jail for many years, and then they ended up getting married and having kids together.
Yeah.
And it's based loosely on the tabloid story of Mary Kay Letourneau. And I think this film has, it's way up there for both Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore is like some of the best performances they've ever given. I think the
Absolutely.
weakest category at the Oscars was maybe Best Supporting Actress. Like you have American Ferrera nominated, I didn't actually see two of the ones,
Color
Jodie
Purple.
Foster, yeah, and Naiad. But it's like
Yeah.
I wish I would have loved to seen Penelope Cruz nominated for Ferrari.
Oh, yeah.
Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I would love to have seen
Rachel McAdams.
Rachel McAdams nominated. But I very much would have liked to have seen Julianne Moore and Natalie Portman nominated. I think they just give such layered, interesting performances because there's all these layers of their actresses playing, one's playing an actress and one's going to study a person to play them. And it's just, there's so much about performance and hiding, your truth or, how are you going to depict, what happened in the past. And like I said, Charles Melton was like a revelation to me.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I totally have a crush on him now, along
Yeah,
with Barry Keoghan. But also, he's like very legitimately a great performance in the
Oh yeah,
film.
it's one of the best performances of the year for my money. Like easily top 10. He's
Yes,
incredible.
I'm happy to see that he's in talks to star in the new Todd Solondz film, which I'm intrigued by, which has been multiple cast in and out. For at one point, it was Penelope Cruz and Edgar Ramirez, and then it was going to be a Lobster reunion with Colin Farrell and Rachel Weisz, and now it's going to be Elizabeth Olsen and Charles Melton, latest I've heard.
I think he
But
was also cast in the next Alex Garland movie. I think I saw that.
yes, but yeah, May, December. I think it's one of I mean, he's one of those directors where I like so many of his movies. Like, I remember sometimes, do you ever see a critic say, like, this is this director's best film since this movie? And it's like two movies ago. So you're like, so you just mean it's better than the last one, you know? But I actually really like Dark Waters. That's a movie that nobody saw.
Yeah, I didn't see it either.
Mark Ruffalo. It was
Sort
like
of
very,
courtroom drama, paranoid thriller kind
it
of
was
thing, like
like,
a
it was
70s
like,
movie.
yeah, it was like Alan J. Pakula movie, you know, like Parallax View. It's like nothing queer about it or kind of transgressive like a lot of his movies are. Todd Haynes, one of the great gay filmmakers of the last 30 years. But yeah, I very much recommend May, December on Netflix. It's number one higher than you,
Yeah,
than me,
exactly.
six.
So yeah, I absolutely love this movie. I watched it on back-to-back days. Actually, I saw it in the theaters and then it came out on Netflix the next day while I still had a Netflix subscription, and I watched it the next day as well. It's like a mesmerizing movie. It's got a great use of score that was adapted from a movie from the early 70s. It's a Michel Legrand score, I think.
Yes, the Go-Betweeners or something like
Something
that.
like that. Yeah, it's a
Julie
great
Christie.
movie about performance. And storytelling, the stories we tell ourselves, the stories we present to other people. Definitely one of the most nuanced and layered performances of Natalie Portman's career. And a side of herself that I think it's sort of at her best when she's like a little bit kind of scary and a little bit manipulative. I think she plays that incredibly well. And Julianne Moore has this like really bizarre accent that just works so well for her character, where she's got this sort of like lisp thing, and she projects this like image of naivety and sort of like innocence. She did a terrible thing, but presents herself as this sort of like homely, like very moral kind of person. So really interesting character study, brilliantly made, great. I think it's one of the best acted movies of the year. Extremely well written. I think what's the name of that writer?
Sammy Birch.
Sammy, I was thinking Alice Birch, but I was like, it's definitely not her.
No, you're
Sammy
getting
Birch.
mixed up with the film that Moore won Best Actress for, Still Alice, maybe.
So yeah, I love May December. It's one higher on mine than it is on yours. So I
Yes.
think we have just enough time for you to squeeze in your next one.
Well, it's a big monster one. It's number six is Godzilla Minus One.
Oscar-winning movie.
Yes, that made me. That maybe was the one I was the happiest about. When, even though I could understand virtually none of the acceptance speech, he really needed Bong Joon-ho's translator.
And they
Well,
had
no,
their
it's
little
not.
Godzilla figurines they brought up with them on stage, which was very cute.
And you see any pictures? Their shoes had like claws on them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, look at
You could
those.
tell just how happy they were to be
Yes,
there.
and it reminds me, you know, because that movie probably cost like a fraction of like any of the other films nominated. It was like, you know,
What, Godzilla vs. Kong is coming out this month or
yeah,
whatever. It's
I
probably like
know.
quarter of the price of that.
But Godzilla Minus One, we reviewed it, and I mean, it might be the film I was most thoroughly entertained by last year. I mean, it just, you want a Godzilla movie, it just absolutely delivers. It is emotional, it is thrilling, it makes Godzilla scary again. And I saw it twice in the theater. I saw it in IMAX, and then I took my mom to see it, and she liked it. I am not a Godzilla expert, but I've certainly seen the original Japanese film, and I think it's probably the best Godzilla film ever made. Like, it's even better than the original film. And it's just so supremely entertaining. And I can't recommend it enough. I mean, even if you're not like, oh, I'm not gonna go see a Godzilla film, like, it's actually really good. Like, I would, unless you were just like really a snob, I can't imagine someone watching that movie and not being very entertained and engrossed by it.
And a great sort of human story at the center of it. I think it works for pretty much like all ages. I think people from, I don't know, what would you say the youngest audience that could sort of watch it is?
I
Like
mean, you
maybe
could take like,
10?
Yeah, I mean it's scary, but it's not all that violent. And I just think that it's just, like I said, it might, there's movies that I was entertained by in their own way, but Godzilla Minus One is just, it so delivers. Like I've been telling people, like I was like rocking in my seat like an autistic child during parts of the movie because it was just like it like you're just like, oh my gosh, he's gonna do that. And but also one of the biggest praise I could give it is that you could take out all the monster parts and it would still be a good solid drama. And then you add Godzilla like destroying a city and shooting his fire breath and his spikes coming out of his back, and you're like, oh my God, it's so cool. So I'm totally a monster kid. I grew up watching the Universal Monster films, and this movie just I went gaga for. So the number six on my list. And honestly, I could put it even higher, but I have to be a little pretentious and not have it. But it does match. We'll have a little teaser. It very much goes together in some ways, would make an interesting double feature with my number five film, which I think may
Yes.
be in your list.
So what a great way to set up the turn as we enter your back half. So we are going to take a very short break and then be back with what would make a very good double feature with Godzilla Minus One. So we will be back in just a second. We are back halfway through Jonathan's top 10 of 2023, and with an excellent transition setting up his, what is this, number five?
Yes, and speaking of films with great editing and transitions,
Yes.
and this podcast will not be as long as this film. My second film that's 3 hours or longer, right at 3 hours, is Oppenheimer, film that won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Lead Actor, Cillian Murphy, Best Supporting Actor, Robert Downey Jr., as well as a few technical awards, even though Poor Things won a few more than people were, I think, were predicting.
Oh yeah.
But
And guess what?
Oppenheimer, what?
This is also my number five.
Oh, symmetry. Very
Oh,
good. I saw it opening weekend in IMAX 70 millimeter. I went to see it again in regular theaters, but still 70 millimeter. And I am a admirer of Christopher Nolan. I like more of his films than I dislike. I think that he is one of the great craftsmen. I mean, on a technical level, there's hardly anyone making films better on a,
yeah.
just the cinematography, the costumes, the production design, the score, just like every technical aspect is just absolutely first rate. I mean, it's like up there with Denis Villeneuve and, or I would still say Martin Scorsese and Spielberg. But I thought that his previous film, Tenet, was his worst film, and I was a little bit down on Nolan. But I think that Oppenheimer is the best film he's made to date. Would you agree with that, or would you have Dunkirk at number one because you're such a fan of period piece war films?
I mean, I think Dunkirk and Memento, I think Memento, I was at such a great age for seeing that for the first time. I think it was like 12 or 13, where it's just
Oppenheimer's
like,
the top three somewhere.
yes, I think it's in the top three. Memento has such a special place. And when you're like 13 and you see Memento, you're just like, oh my God, movies could do stuff like this. And then, yeah, because I'm such like a period piece World War II junkie, Dunkirk, very much up there for me. But Oppenheimer, I think, sort of from an objective point of view, you could say is like, the coming together of all the things that make Christopher Nolan kind of an auteur and a really unique filmmaker these days to make a movie like this that was as successful as it was, I think almost $1 billion worldwide.
He made a
What?
3-hour R-rated biopic set in the 40s and 50s about a scientist that has real dark, moral quandaries about
Yeah.
the fate
And
of
one of the
humanity.
more horrifying final shots of like any major Hollywood motion picture that I can remember, with just the world engulfed in flame. So yeah, I mean, people are going to look back on this and be like, "What? Oppenheimer made $1 billion? That's so crazy!" And you'd have to say a big part of its success was just the name Christopher Nolan and the brand he's established for himself. And I know it created a pretty big rift with Warner Brothers, who had produced all of his films since Memento, I think. And they were
And
not
he,
interested in
yeah.
financing this one, and ended up putting Barbie out in the same weekend as a sort of like FU to Oppenheimer, I think.
Well, I think that also what part of it was Nolan's dissatisfaction. I mean, partially it was
Oh,
not.
with Tenet, yeah, with the direct or same day theater release, same day streaming strategy that they did with like Matrix Revolutions, or what
Well,
was it
they
with
did
Matrix?
basically their whole run of 2021 films, Dune, which people should see in a theater.
Yeah, which is a crazy one to think about. I didn't even re I forgot that that was like day and date, because I did see it in the theater and it was such a great theater experience that to release it on streaming is just so crazy. I can see why he was
But
pretty upset about that.
yeah, I mean, Oppenheimer on a t like I was saying, Nolan in general, even the films I don't like. I mean, like Tenet's incredibly well made on a technical level. It's just stupid and it's ponderous and
And meaningless.
but Oppenheimer is it's one of those great movies where it is smart and it's incredibly well acted, but it's also just immensely entertaining just to be swept up in it 3 hours. I mean, it just is such a full meal of a film, and you just feel like this is what cinema can do.
Oh yeah.
And has a great, I mean, it has a amazing lineup of actors. I mean, it's Matt Damon is one of his best performances, I think. You have Emily Blunt nominated for the first time. Robert Downey Jr. finally won an Oscar. It's one of those movies that, like, on IMDb, the trivia is like it has like six Oscar winners and like 12 nominees or something like, and not that many, but it has like Gary Oldman and
They brought
what's his
Josh
face?
Hartnett back from the dead to give one of
I
my
know.
favorite supporting performances of the year.
And Casey Affleck has a great little part in the movie. You know what's as weird is when they did the SAG
For
nominations,
ensemble.
yeah, it had like eight people, and it's like there's like 30 name actors in it. Like they didn't
Might have more
put.
like speaking roles than any Hollywood movie of like the last 10 years.
Yeah,
Like there's
it's
so
like
much
you had
talking in
like
this. I
Oscar.
think Paul Schrader described it as like an action movie with words. Which is very much how this is. Like for as
Well, yeah, 75% of the movie, if you added it up, is people like sitting in or standing in a room talking
yeah, about like
about
kind of
science,
nebulous concepts. Yeah. And
right?
it makes
Moral.
it palatable. It's an incredible achievement of Christopher Nolan in
Well,
screenwriting.
it's a very different. They're very different, but it's like Moneyball and Margin Call, where like I couldn't after the movie explain everything or virtually anything that they're talking about, but while you're watching it,
You're
you
like,
grasp it
yeah,
enough and
this
you
makes sense.
understand the characters understand.
Yes.
You understand the motivations and the what they're trying to accomplish, even if you can't parse through exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah, you're like, okay, it's something with quasars or something.
And
And
it's amazing that it's all without a frame of CGI in it. That's
it's
incredible. And it's
crazy, yeah.
ridiculous that it wasn't even on the short list for visual effects. Like, what's
Yes.
that? What
Well,
is
it's
that?
one of those things where I think like the people's idea of visual effects is like something you can kind of tell is CGI in like a weird sort of way. Which Oppenheimer's, because it's all practical, like looks like it doesn't use them, but obviously there are visual effects. And it's, yeah, it's really the kind of visual effects we should be rewarding, instead of some of the ones that we ended up seeing it. Have we mentioned Cillian Murphy, best actor winner?
Next city
Outstanding
one,
central performance. And an actor who's been a great character actor for a long time. I think the first movie I would have seen him in was 28 Days Later or Batman Begins, maybe sometime around then. And then he really blew me away in a movie called The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which is a Mike Leigh movie from 2005 that won the
Ken
Palme d'Or.
Loach.
Ken Loach, yeah, sorry, I mixed up my socialist English directors. Ken Loach, yes, very much a northern man. But outstanding movie, and he big in Peaky Blinders, which is a show I only watched the first season of because it was unhealthy for me to watch something that made me want to smoke cigarettes so badly. So I gave that up because I didn't think it was good for my personal hygiene. But yeah, outstanding actor. It's really nice to see him get his moment. He gave one of the sort of better speeches of the night, and very interested to see what kind of roles he gets offered moving forward, because he's been a lead in smaller movies, but in a big movie like this, he's usually a supporting actor. I mean, mostly in Nolan movies, he's sort of been the supporting roles.
He's been in about half of his movies,
Yeah, it's like a
honestly.
20-year working relationship between the two of them, and you could just
Almost,
tell
yeah.
how happy Nolan was for him to get his award. And also Nolan's first directing Oscar, right? Had he won?
He had
Had he
been
even?
nominated multiple times, been nominated for directing for Dunkirk. And was this only, he wasn't nominated for Inception, was he? I think that
No, I
was
don't
one
think,
people
or
were
The Dark
surprised.
Knight or anything like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a real crowning moment for them last week for Christopher Nolan and for Cillian Murphy, and a great day for Ireland because despite Daniel Day-Lewis being an Irish actor, he was not actually born in the country. So we're recording this on St. Patrick's Day, so a real shout out for Ireland's own from Cork, Cillian Murphy. They did some like features in Ireland on like RTE, which is the national news network, going back to his school, interviewing little kids about how happy they were for a Corkman to win Best Actor. So, very cool moment for that. So, I think we're both pretty satisfied. I mean, it was not our number one either of us. Obviously, we both had it at number five, but I think a
They were
worthy Best
top
Picture
five.
winner. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, Oppenheimer.
I like to say that in the last like 15 years, more often than not, the film that won Best Picture, even if it wasn't my personal favorite, like was pretty critically regarded as actually the best film of the year. Like No Country for Old Men, The Hurt Locker, Parasite, Moonlight, Spotlight, Nomadland, Everything Everywhere. Like those all were like literally the best reviewed film of the year critically, or like way up there, like in the top five at least. So it, you know, yes, Green Book and Coda shouldn't have won. But they've actually been fairly good about what's won Best Picture, 12 Years a Slave.
Birdman.
Anyway, one movie, I will go to my number four if you
Oh, yeah.
Is a film that I felt was a little bit underrepresented at the Oscars. Got nominated for Best Picture, but only one other nomination, Best Original Screenplay. One of the great directorial debuts in recent years is Celine Song's Past Lives.
And guess what, Jonathan?
What?
It is also my number four.
Oh, very good. Yes. I thought that this was such an assured, moving, just really accomplished first film. It's written and directed by this woman, Celine Song, that has been successful in theater, but this she had
Yes.
never even done a short before, and she shot this film on film like Nolan, and it was released by A24. It premiered at Sundance a little over a year ago now,
Yeah.
but it came out in the summer, came out before Barbenheimer. I think it must then be the earliest released film of the Best Picture nominees. Yeah, I just thought it was lovely and incredibly well acted. I remember there was someone that tweeted the day of the Oscar nominations, ranking of Oscar snubs for Greta, number one, Lee, two, Gerwig. Because
Yeah.
I felt like I would have loved to have seen Greta Lee nominated for Best
Oh,
Actress.
yeah.
I just thought, it's kind of a three-hander, almost all the film is just these three actors.
Yes.
And I don't know that we need to recount the plot. I mean, just see it if you haven't seen it, and or go back and to listen our review. But it's just such a lovely, well-written. It's so well written. I'm glad it at least got nominated for screenplay.
Yes. The screenplay, yeah, is as good as the performances are in the direction, the screenplay is probably the sort of standout aspect of it. It's so assured as a debut feature. And she'd worked in theater, obviously, but it is a different thing writing for movies than it is writing for theater. And the confidence, the assuredness, I mean, it seemed like she was old hat at it, Celine Song, and
And
the
it's not
direction.
flashy. It's like
No,
just
it's
so
such a
subtle.
quiet movie. And it wears its influences on its sleeve a little bit. People have mentioned the Before trilogy and I think In the Mood for Love as things you could sort of see as forerunners of this movie, but it's not just retreading those movies. It brings its own sort of distinct voice to a kind of story that we might have seen before. The actors playing the characters at different ages I thought was amazing. And what is it, Michael Angarano? Is that the person who plays the husband? was one of my favorite performances of the year, and
John
it's
Magaro, yeah.
John Magara, yeah, Michael Angarana. I'm confusing so many names.
A bit in the last two Kelly Reichardt films, First
yes,
Cow and
and it's a
Shelley
great
Miller.
movie where there's like no bad guy and like no one really does anything wrong, but
There's even
there's
a speech about that.
exactly, but there's like still conflict, and it's just like about how emotions can be difficult things to maneuver, and relationships can be difficult things to maneuver, and just like such a great human story, really beautifully shot. It makes great use of different New York locations. Brooklyn Bridge Park, one of my favorite places to go when I lived in Brooklyn, is prominently featured in the movie, so I really appreciated that. There's a great extended take of the two main characters walking past the Brooklyn Bridge and sort of into the carousel that's very prominently featured in the movie. So I really liked seeing parts of New York City that aren't always sort of displayed on film, shot in this movie in a really beautiful way on film. Yes, very human movie, a pretty quiet movie, but I haven't heard of anyone who's seen it that didn't like it. So if you want to give a chance on a sort of more artistic, quieter, but very, very human movie, Past Lives are both of our number fours of 2023. Highly recommend to pretty much any person who's capable of experiencing emotion and has lived a life and had interactions with people and missed connections. So, one of my favorite movies of the year, absolutely.
Well, my number three film is not in the 3 hours or longer camp, but it's about 2 hours and 45 minutes. And I know you haven't seen this movie unless you watched it, because I've been raving about it for a year and a half. Because I actually saw this film at the 2022 New York Film Festival. It premiered in May
Oh my
of
goodness.
2022 at Cannes. So it's almost been out 2 years now, but it got a brief limited theatrical release in the US early in 2023. So it counts as a 2023 theatrical US release. It's this movie, Pacifiction, I think is how you pronounce it, directed by a man named Albert Serra. And it is a long, slow, confounding foreign language film. And I don't know what to make of it, but I think it's a great film. And the actor, who I will not be able to pronounce his name, Benit Mego, I don't know. He stars in The Taste of Things. He's the male lead in that. He was the young man and the piano teacher. He won the César Award for Best Actor at Cannes for, I mean, at the César Awards, like the French Oscars. He won Best Actor for this film.
Majumel.
Yes, thank you. I think this is a great film. I was thoroughly engrossed by it. It's just beautifully shot. I don't even want to say anything about it, because I don't even know that I could do it justice. But it's just I mean, it's like I just thought it was one of the best films I saw at the 2022 New York Film Festival. And I like know two people that have even seen it, and they both really liked it, but no one else has seen this movie. I would have voted for Best Actor. I would have voted for it for Best International Feature Film. I don't think it was even eligible at the Oscars. I don't think they even submitted it, because there was no way it was going to get nominated. Yeah, I highly recommend this movie. It's streaming. You can watch it. You had not heard of it until I mentioned it, right? You've heard me
Nope.
raving about it,
Yeah.
right? So,
The
yeah.
first audience review that pops up on Google, one star, worst movie I have ever seen. The plot goes nowhere. Every scene goes on 5 times longer than it should. They tried to sell it as a slow thriller, but in reality, there is never suspense to be found in the sluggishly slow 3 hours of seemingly improvised dialogue. So a very different take from you.
Yeah, well, the critics liked it mostly. It is on Mubi if you have Mubi,
And it
but
looks like also on Prime Video. So yeah, maybe if you're in the mood for something that'll push your boundaries as an audience member a little further than maybe some of the ones on my top 10,
yes,
Pacifiction.
the I've only seen one other film by this director. He did a movie called The Death of Louis the. What was the You're better with history. What number would it have been?
It's 14, right?
Yes, 14th, and it stars the lead actor who was the boy in the 400 Blows,
Yes.
Jean-Pierre Léaud. So they say his name.
Jean-Paul Léon.
Yeah. And basically, it's just under 2 hour movie watching him like lying in bed with a big powdered wig dying and like nothing happens in the. It's basically an anti-biopic where it's just like just in very boring detail watching like the last few weeks of a historical figure dying and nothing happens. And
The
like you see him
longest
like.
reigning European monarch
Yes.
beat
I did.
Elizabeth II by 2 years.
I do want to watch his movie that I got on UK DVD a few months ago. It's called Story of My Death, and it's an interesting conceit. It's Count Dracula meets Casanova.
Interesting.
I'm very intrigued. But yeah,
Histoire
so
de ma mort.
yes. So I'm a big fan of Passive Fiction. Watch it on movie. Not everyone will like it. It's my least seen film. That of like probably has the least number of people in the world to have seen this movie, but Passive Fiction is my number three. Okay, my number two film, also underseen but very well reviewed, came out early in the year. It's probably the at least the theatrical release. Maybe Passive Fiction came out technically earlier, but Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, is my number
Wow,
two film.
very high up on your list.
Yes, I just thought this was a lovely, really fun. I mean, I don't think people talk about how like this movie's really funny. Like
It
it's I
is.
like laughed a lot during the movie. Like my number one, I don't want to give it away, but it's a really good period piece. It's set this film in 1970 when the original novel came out. Judy Blume is a beloved young adult writer who has never let until this film let any of her works be made into film or television.
Really? Oh,
And
wow.
this writer director Kelly Freeman Craig, who had only done one other feature film as a writer director,
The Edge of
and
17.
yes, with Haley Steinfeld, she wrote her and said, "I would love to make a film of your book." And she had seen that film and really admired it. And she said, "Let's go." It's produced by James L. Brooks, the legendary TV and film producer and director. And yeah, it's just I've never been an 8-year-old girl, 10-year-old girl, but it seems like it so captures the awkwardness, the changes that a young woman, person becoming a woman, dealing with things like someone's first girl's first period, and boys and going to school, and it's just such a humane. Like just it just and it's but it has like a weight to it. Like it's oddly like one of the better films about religion in recent
Yeah.
years. And it has a great supporting cast. It has Benny Safdie as the father. You have Rachel McAdams, who I would have nominated for Best Supporting Actress, as not a very convincing as a Jewish grandmother, but Kathy Bates is really
Kathy
lovely in the
Bates.
movie. Yeah, there's all these movies in recent years with non-Jewish people playing Jewish people,
The
like The
Fablemans
Fablemans,
was, yeah, very notable.
Helen Mirren playing Golda, getting nominated for her fake nose, Maestro with Bradley Cooper, but it's just a lovely movie. Really, just I just thought it was so good, and it just didn't do very well at the box office. It got
No,
really
it
good
didn't.
reviews. But I mean, basically, if a movie doesn't come out in the last, 3 months of the year, people forget about it. And so I always point out, like I look at my like I listen to all these different film podcasts. Like once the Oscars ends until like August, like it's such a dry spell of like they interview people like when a new Blu-ray comes out or like
Yeah.
there's like little indie movies that come out, but there's stuff that premieres at film festivals like Berlin and Cannes, but people there are good movies that come out in the first half of the year.
Oh yeah, this is definitely one of them. And in addition to giving a great sort of insight into what it's like to be, a preteen girl, it's really good at getting the experience of raising one as well through Rachel McAdams' character, who's really a central focus of it. And it is a supporting performance, but it almost gives as much attention to her journey struggling with a move from like being in a big city of New York to living in a suburban environment where you're expected to do all these sort of different things. And one of my favorite scenes was when she had to do stuff for an upcoming school event where
Right.
she's cutting like paper mache sorts of things. And just because she's like so new to it, she doesn't necessarily understand how to get out of being involved in things like that. So it was her best performance in some time, from what I remember, Rachel McAdams. I think she's obviously
She
been in stuff, but I feel like Spotlight was the last thing I saw that she really impressed me in.
She kind of took a break for a little bit. I saw her on CBS Sunday Morning because I'm a 70-year-old person watching CBS Sunday Morning. They do really good stories, but she actually stepped away for a few years because she had her own young child. But yeah, she had had a small part in Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness in 2022. When she was in that, didn't you like the Eurovision
I
Song
did.
Contest?
But
Yeah.
that's a very silly sort of movie. I don't necessarily think of that as one of her strongest
Yeah.
acting roles.
Yes,
Yeah,
but
I've never read a Judy Blume book, I think. I wasn't really aware of her cultural significance, really, even until I saw this movie and then, did some Wikipedia research on the subject. So yeah, you recommended this very highly, so I had your sort of like overwhelmingly positive opinion of it, framing my viewing of it, but I very much appreciated and really enjoyed this movie. I actually watched it with my mom, so it was a nice viewing experience for the both of us, I think. So yeah, underseen movie, but one more people should see, and hopefully it'll be, a sort of young adult movie people watch moving into the future. So I have high hopes for this one's legacy and its continuing legs as we move forward, and its, streaming and home release sort of years.
Should I go on to my number one, which I'm almost certain is in your top 10, if not also your number one?
Well, I guess maybe this would be a good time for me to fill in mine because I think we finished
Yes.
with the same one.
Yes.
So my number 10 was The Holdovers, directed by Alexander Payne. I'm not exactly the biggest Alexander Payne fan. I like a lot of his movies like Sideways, and The Descendants I quite like. I'm not a completist in the way that you are, so I have still yet to see Election, which I know was sort of his big breakthrough. And Nebraska, which got an Oscar nomination for actor and supporting actress, I believe, right? For June
Yeah,
Squibb
and he
and
got
Bruce Dern.
nominated for director for it.
Yes, but The Holdovers is very much a kind of throwback movie, in some ways, kind of like artificially framed as being released in 1970. They even use like a retro studio. What do you call those things?
Logo.
A logo, yeah, at the beginning of the movie. It starts off kind of one way and becomes something very different by the end of the movie, where it starts as sort of being like a boarding school comedy and ends up being like a really precise, moving character study of its three lead characters. So I know Paul Giamatti was nominated for Best Actor and Divine Joy Randolph won Supporting Actress and basically won every award for Supporting Actress, I think, throughout the whole year. Those were the two categories everyone knew who was going to win was Supporting Actress and Supporting Actor. And a revelatory performance by Dominic Sessa as the young boarder whose parents kind of ignore him in the holiday period, and he has to stay at the boarding school over the Christmas break. And just, it's a very, a lot of people were sort of talking about it's like a comfort holiday movie, which I know Alexander Payne pushed back on a lot, but it's very melancholy in a lot of ways. The main character, in a lot of ways, is like not a nice sort of person you'd like to be around, and he kind of enjoys.
Curmudgeon.
Yeah, he kind of enjoys being a curmudgeon, but then you realize underneath that, like, he's a very sensitive person who has all these sort of like missed opportunities in life and doesn't necessarily like the way his life has ended up. And then you have that counteracted with Dominic Sessa's character, who's, just beginning his journey in the world. And the way they bounce off each other was incredible. And it's one of the best written movies of the year, definitely for me. So yeah, The Holdovers at number 10 for me.
And I just to say it's also very funny and
Yes.
enjoyable. It's not
Yes.
a chore at all. It's a very enjoyable film to watch, even though it
No.
gets a sad and melancholy too.
Yes. It's one that a lot of people I know who aren't necessarily big movie people loved The Holdover. So that is my number 10. My number 9, I don't think you have seen Scrapper, directed by Charlotte Regan.
I did not.
Really funny independent British movie that reminded me a lot of The Hunt for the Wilder People, directed by Taika Waititi from a few years ago, because it's just like a very creative, very funny movie about a young person sort of engaging with the world and sometimes doing borderline criminal activities. And then she's reunited with her father, played by Harris Dickinson, after her mother has passed away. And it's very much about a father sort of rediscovering his relationship with his daughter. And it's very, very funny. It's extremely assured debut film by Charlotte Regan. one of my favorite movies of the year, definitely, as it makes my top 10. So I highly recommend this to everybody. I don't know if it's streaming anywhere, but it's very short at 84 minutes, and I couldn't imagine people seeing this and not liking it. It's really funny. It's beautifully shot. It's a very human story, and Harris Dickinson is very much on the come up after being in The Iron Claw and some other what was the one Triangle of Sadness. So very much an actor to look out for, and this is my favorite performance I've seen of him so far.
It's available to rent on pretty much all the streaming services, and it's also on Showtime.
Well, there you go. My number eight, and we've reviewed all the others of these, so I don't have to talk about them too long. My number eight, The Boy and the Heron, directed by Hayao Miyazaki, was the winner of animated feature. I think Miyazaki's second win. This is a pretty weird movie. I think we both came to that conclusion, but really beautifully animated, has incredible vocal performances. I haven't seen it subtitled yet. That's how you saw it, right? It was the subtitled
Yes,
version.
and it is actually going to be re-released next Friday, March 22nd in theaters.
Yes, and really great dub performances. So I know both of us usually, not usually, basically always prefer to watch international features in their original language with subtitles. But sort of the only thing I make an allowance for is Miyazaki, because it's usually extremely well cast for the dub performances. And Robert
All
Pattinson.
animated films are dubbed.
Yeah, it's true. So yeah,
Yeah.
you can make a sort of excuse for that. So The Boy and the Heron is my number eight. My number seven, Poor Things, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos, kind of like cleaned up at the Oscars in a way that I didn't necessarily expect for things like production design, and one costume design, I think, and was the
Makeup. Yeah, they
makeup. Yeah.
thought Maestro was going to win makeup. Yeah, I think most people thought it was only going to win the costume
Yeah.
or production design maybe, and then it also won lead actress, which I was actually very happy. I would have voted for all the movies I saw last year. I would have voted for Emma Stone for best actress and Mark Ruffalo for supporting actor.
Yes, so a very sort of fantastical movie about a sort of woman's journey into the world and interacting with obviously a pretty male-dominated sort of fantasy-like 19th century Europe. Really beautiful movie, extremely well acted, really funny, very raunchy. It has more sex than you're likely to see in most American movies. Like if you could consider this to be an American movie, with I think a lot of a British crew and a Greek director, but a largely American cast.
I'd like to point out that the last two films you did, Poor Things and The Boy and the Heron, I had it alphabetical 11 through 15. They would both be in my 11 through 15.
Okay. I know that my next one will probably not be in your top 20. I know it was much higher on this movie than you were. This is my number three, Barbie, directed by Greta Gerwig. It's just one of the most fun theater experiences I've had in a really long time. It's just a celebration of life and color and comedy and sort of old Hollywood. There's one of my favorite scenes of the year was the I'm Just Ken musical number, which was garnered a lot of praise from directors maybe you wouldn't expect to have liked a movie about Barbie. But I thought this was very funny. It was very uplifting and was just a joy for me to watch. And I probably have this ranked a bit higher than you'd see on most top 10 lists because it just made me so happy. And I've gone back to watch it m probably more times than any other movie that was released in 2023.
I
So,
saw it twice because
oh, look at
I
that.
ended my history of cinema class with it. I went from a bunch of silent shorts and Caligari to Barbie. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think it's a very funny movie. It's incredibly inventive. It just there are at least 10 other movies I liked more last
Yeah.
year. It's I have, very little criticisms of the movie. I very much enjoyed it, but it's not top 10.
Not top 10. So that was my number
No.
three. And our number one, I am almost positive we have the same one. We
Yes.
both think this is probably America's greatest living director.
Now, have you
And
gone through all yours now except number one?
I have in our number one.
Wait, what's your number two?
My number two was, oh, sorry, you didn't mention this. Anatomy of a Fall, Justine Triet.
Yes.
I'm sorry, I forgot about that. Love this movie. My favorite line of the year. Your generosity conceals something darker and meaner. I like that pops up on my Instagram Discover page all the time. I've probably like listened to that quote a million times. The courtroom drama is back. Justine Triet, with one of the great screenplays of recent years. I love, love, love this movie. I watched it
Oscar
twice in
winning.
theaters. Oscar-winning screenplay, Anatomy of a Fall. Loved it. Go back and listen to our review of it if you want a more in-depth one. But our
Yeah,
number one.
I really liked Anatomy of, I liked Anatomy of Fall. I just didn't like it as much as some people did. It's like, it's just a really solid movie, but it's
Yeah.
like 4 out of 5 stars for me. And I was
Palme
like,
d'Or winner though. So the
yes.
Palme d'Or jury agrees with me.
Yes.
Beat Out, I believe, the number one, which was
Yes.
premiered at Cannes Film
Killers of the
Festival,
Flower Moon.
directed by Martin Scorsese. Shut out at the Oscars. One of the great travesties of recent times.
10
Jonathan,
nominations, 0 wins.
tell us why this is the best and most important movie of the year, Jonathan.
Like Frederick Wiseman, Martin Scorsese is not going to do too many more films, sadly. I hope he makes it, as many as he feels like. But he is now 81 years old, and I think that he is making films as good as he's ever made and as
Yes.
important as he's ever made. And this movie is 3 hours and 26 minutes. I was completely engrossed, enthraled, moved, enraged,
Yeah.
just completely enveloped in this movie. I mean, yes, I've said this about other movies, every technical aspect, the cinematography by Prieto, who also shot Barbie.
Yeah, Rodrigo Prieto.
Yes, the late Robbie Robertson did the score, the legendary Thelma Shoemaker, a longtime editor.
Yes.
Shot every one of his films since Raging Bull, as well as his first feature. And I just think the performances are, I think it's, one of the best things Leo's done. I think it's like one of the three best things De Niro's done in like
Oh,
25
yeah.
years. I don't
He's one
deny
of the
like.
great movie villains of sort of recent memory, like in such a quiet way, the scariest movie villain maybe I've ever seen.
And I think it was Vulture did an article about how like, how, we're kind of sleeping on like that, like, hey, like De Niro is giving like one of his best performance in years, like one of the best performance of the year. Like he got nominated in a lot of places, but I think people are like, yeah, he's good. But like, no, it's like he's so good in the movie.
Yeah.
And even though I would have, and I'm glad that Emma Stone won Best Actress, Lily Gladstone is really the heart in the center of this
Yes.
movie. You could argue maybe she would have won if she had been in supporting actress, but it's like that's hard to
Yeah.
decide when what category something goes in. Yeah, but it's is it a masterpiece? Is it where is it in the all-time ranking of Scorsese? I'm gonna wait a few years, but
Yeah.
it's one of his best films. And I think also the coda at the end is really brilliant, and it
Oh
puts in the
yeah.
whole context. That's really,
Yes.
really
And apparently
fascinating.
was tagged on after production had wrapped by about like 3 months or so and just occurred to Scorsese, like this is really how it should end. Left me completely devastated. Like you said, this it's you feel so many different things when you're watching this, like anger, sadness, and some moments like real sort of like joy. And a lot of that has to do with Lily Gladstone's central performance. She really is the heartbeat of this movie, and I just love, love, love this movie so much. I think it's so good. I think every American should see this. But yeah, I don't think we've mentioned a lot of the supporting performances. A lot of the speaking roles in this movie were actors I had never seen before, aside from the major ones like DiCaprio and De Niro. And I don't think I'd actually ever seen Lily Gladstone in a movie before because she was in some Kelly Reichardt movies, like Certain Women, I think was her
Yes,
sort of
that's
big
where a
break
lot.
before this.
Yeah, she would have been my pick for best supporting actress for that film that year, and she had a small part in First Cal. But yeah, she this certainly put her on the map. And there's some really notable Native American actors who you maybe don't know their names, but if you go look at their IMDb list, they've been working for many years. And it's like 2 hours and 45 minutes in the movie, both John Lithgow and Brendan Fraser pop up for about 10 minutes. Yeah, and you have some singers, one of whom I won't give away because he shows up in the very end of the movie.
Yes.
But St what's his name? Sturgill.
Sturgill Simpson and Jason
Yeah.
Isbell both have like pretty prominent roles that not only like deliver one line but a lot of lines over many scenes.
Yes.
So yeah, this is just a great movie of interesting faces, and people you think would have occupied the sort of milieu that they're living in. Like, not everyone in this movie looks perfect and beautiful. A lot of them look very real sort of faces you see, even DiCaprio. I mean, he's obviously still Leonardo DiCaprio, but he dirties himself down and makes
Yeah.
himself a little more rugged than maybe we're used to seeing him.
I heard Bill Maher saying that, really they should have had like a 25-year-old actor play that role and not someone who's like turning 50 next year or this year.
But that's like discounting what Hollywood is, because this movie wouldn't have been made if someone besides Leonardo DiCaprio was playing that role. So
Well,
that
they could have gotten like, a Timothée Chalamet era actor, but who just announced he was in the two highest grossing films of the last 8 months, Wonka and Dune Part Two. So he's swooping
Wow.
up.
Yeah,
But
he
no, I
is.
mean, but I don't think that Timmy has the same presence. Not that he doesn't have any, but he doesn't have the same
No.
as, yeah, it's one of the best things Leo's done. I've never been the biggest fan of Leo. I think that there's some films where he's ironically connected to this film, when he played J. Edgar Hoover and the Clint Eastwood film. Like, why would you cast him as J. Edgar Hoover? Like, that's just like they should have gotten like a Philip Seymour Hoffman type or
Yes.
someone like someone with some heft to him naturally. But
Yeah.
yeah, I mean, I think that all the performances are really strong. It's kind of there's the three big performances, but it's populated with all these really strong supporting performances. And like I was saying, it's so well made on every level. It's just top of the line, in every category. I'm glad it did get 10 nominations. Not like the
Yeah.
Academy ignored it. It just didn't win any.
Yeah.
But
And
yeah,
also,
it's
it feels a lot different than a lot of other Scorsese movies. I mean, it deals with similar subjects of, like violence and control and intimidation and marginalized
morality.
groups to some extent, morality, sort of moral gray lines. But yeah, like the mixture at the beginning with documentary footage, with more, I guess, sort of like formal stage footage was really interesting, and the way they humanized the indigenous Osage people through the historical photographs at the beginning, I thought was really interesting. I mean, as everyone who's listened to multiple episodes of this knows, I love historical movies, and more than most I've seen recently, this really puts you in a time and a place and feels extremely authentic to the period, and does a good job of making history come alive, and how we sometimes think of people who existed in history as, being these sepia colored photographs that aren't like real people behind them. So this really humanizes real historical characters and makes you feel so deeply the struggle and the violence and acts of atrocity precipitated
And
against these people.
I think it's interesting, all of Scorsese's narrative films this century, except for The Departed, which he finally won Best Picture, Best Director for, are all period pieces. Every
Yeah.
single film he's done except The Departed. But I don't think of him as like a director of historical films. They just are like, he does, well, like Gangs of New York is like the closest, but like I think of The Aviator as a Howard Hughes biopic. I think of Silence as, it's a religious film. It's like
Yeah.
I think of Hugo as like his love letter to cinema and
And
like
film
experimenting with
preservation.
3D.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like I don't think of like in Wolf of Wall Street, is not that far in the past. It's like I don't think of them as historical. Goodfellas is a period piece, an older one. Casino, like a lot of his films are set not in the present, but this is a film that I feel like more than any that he's ever done is really tackling history and the kind of the great one of the great sins of America, along
Yeah.
with, slavery. And I think that I've said before that would make a really interesting essay to compare Killers of the Flower Moon and The Zone of Interest about how both films are grappling with how do you make art, how do you depict, how do you dramatize real life atrocity and genocide. And I think both films are really rigorous in their formal displays. Like there's the kind of precise, almost documentary style where they had all these multiple cameras in the Zone of Interest. And then with Killers of the Flower Moon, it does have this kind of sweep and grandeur of like a big epic film, but also there's like a real intimacy and it's like a really character-driven film. I mean, I think that, before the pandemic, when they wrote the initial script, Scorsese and Eric Roth had it as more based on the book by David Grann, that it was
Yeah.
more of a police procedural, and
Yes.
DiCaprio was going to play the one character in the FBI who ends up in the final film being played by Jesse Plemons. But I think that they were, they got to a point where they're like, but what's the heart of the film? Like, what story are we really telling? And they realized they really needed to focus more on the Native American characters and the love story, the twisted, seemingly,
Almost like
unbelievable.
implausible, yeah.
Yeah. But
If it didn't actually happen, you wouldn't believe it.
one of the granddaughters said to Scorsese, like, one of the things she most wanted to get across to him was that they really loved each other. At least, for the first many years of their marriage, that it was like a real love. And I just think it's such a, I still think I might like The Irishman a little more, but Killers is like way up there as one of my certainly favorite of the 21st century of his.
Yes. I mean, in this late stage Scorsese that we're getting, I think you could group Silence, The Irishman, and Killers of the Flower Moon as not necessarily a triptych, but they're all really concerned with pretty serious moral, sort of personal issues of faith. Very serious, very long movies. And I think it's a really interesting way he's capping off his career. And after
The
coming off of
last,
Wolf of Wall Street, which was really like exuberant and very colorful and very kinetic in a way that the last three have been much more like slower pace is not necessarily the way to describe it because some parts of Killers of the Flower Moon really go. But a lot of it is more meditative, I think maybe it might be the right word than maybe how people associated early Scorsese with the soundtrack and flashy editing and a lot of camera movement and stuff like that.
I was going to say the last narrative feature film that he directed that was under 2 hours was The Color of Money,
Wow.
and that was 1 hour and 59 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I would love for Scorsese to just keep making his movies longer and longer and address just even more serious subjects. I think the next one he's doing, if it ends up working out, is like a
Jesus documentary.
oh well, yeah, that's the one coming out this
And
year.
that's maybe not going to be 3.5 hours. Maybe that will be
Yeah, that was
like,
commissioned by Papa Francesco himself, said, Marty, make me a movie about Jesus. And he's like, I'll do it, Pope.
yes, but and like I heard there, like for a while, like a year or so ago, the pair that wrote Ed Wood and The People versus Larry Flint, Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, had written a Grateful Dead. I'm totally blanking. Jerry Garcia
Jerry
biopic
Garcia,
starring
yeah.
Jonah Hill, and I'm like,
Do I really
if
want
that.
that?
Yeah, does he really need to do that? I mean, like, if he was like 62, like, I would totally want to see him do that. But like,
Yeah. Or if
you
there
have
was a
like,
production schedule of like 8 weeks or
it's like, if
something.
you have three films left, I don't know that you need to make a Jerry Garcia biopic.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be amazing, probably, but it's, I don't know. It's like he needs to, I don't know. He's got to, what's his last film going to be? Like, I don't know. I don't want to think about it. I hope he
Oh,
lives
I
to
know.
be 98 and
Well, that's
makes
the thing is he
it.
seems still really motivated about telling stories, and I think he's aware of the sort of limitation on time that he has. So it seems like the projects he's taking on since Silence, I guess, are ones he feels a real urgent need to tell, which
Well,
is
yeah, he even said in an interview last year that he wasn't sure that he necessarily needed to make Shutter Island. He felt
oh,
like,
really? It's like maybe I could have made another one. You want to just put a bow on 2023 here, Jonathan?
Yeah, I thought it was a really good year. I mean, every year there's good movies. There's, I was like, can I just say my 11 through 15 real
Oh,
quick?
yeah, definitely.
One, the movie that, okay, so we already said The Boy and the Heron and Poor Things. One movie that really didn't get a lot of people to see it in the first half of the year, Blackberry. Did
Oh,
you
I
ever
still
see
haven't
that?
even seen that one, no.
Yeah, very funny. They actually have done like a 4-part miniseries version of it, but you can watch the film. It's just like a little over 2 hours. Really funny Canadian film. It like swept the Canadian like awards. Like it won like everything.
Yeah, it won like
Really.
18 awards or something, right?
Yeah, it's like there was only 15
Yeah,
categories. No, but
it's like we're giving special awards to BlackBerry.
but it's a very funny movie, and it's a great it's kind of, I describe it, it's like The Social Network meets In the Loop. It's
Oh.
like Armando Iannucci is kind of this really funny and I would have, I mean, the best supporting actor, it was
Glenn
such a
Howard and
stat, and
Wright.
yeah, he should have been nominated, or he would have been right on the cusp for me. But I really recommend that. I really liked it. Not everyone liked it as much as I really liked Paul Schrader's most recent film, Master Gardener.
Didn't see it.
starring Joel Edgerton and Sigourney Weaver is very good in it. I really
I've heard
liked it.
it forms kind of an unofficial trilogy with The Card Counter and First Reformed.
Yes. I very much like it. It's on Hulu, last I checked. And this may surprise you, but Renaissance, a film by Beyoncé, really was one of the best films I saw
Really?
last year. I really, really liked it. More than the Taylor Swift film, but that was fine. But it's, and that one actually is a documentary, like a three
It's not
fourths of
just
the
a
movie.
concert film.
Yeah. And she actually did, I mean, hence the title, she actually did direct the movie.
Oh,
And
really?
it's like a third of the movie or a fourth of it is like behind the scenes documentary. And I mean, I'm not like nearly as knowledgeable about music, especially of recent years,
The
as
last
I
10
know
years.
as much as I know film, certainly. But I have to admit, I am a card-carrying Beyoncé fan,
You're
and
part of the
she,
beehive.
yeah, I mean, she's just like she. I mean, she really puts on a show in that movie. I mean, I saw it in IMAX, and it's like almost the same exact length. It's like 2 hours and 48 minutes, but it was totally into it. Very much enjoyed it. So, do you have any others like that were right on the cusp that you want to
One that was
recommend?
really on the cusp for me was kind of between that and Scrapper for like the more sort of independent underseen ones was Sanctuary, which I think we reviewed
Yes,
pretty
Margaret
early on in
Qualley.
the year. Yeah, Margaret Qualley, dominatrix thriller. Great movie that takes place in one location, only two actors. It's Margaret Qualley and what's the name of the gentleman who was also
The
in
guy,
Poor Things?
Christopher Abbott,
Christopher Abbott, yes,
who
who I hear.
both also in Poor Things,
Exactly right.
both
So,
sexual films.
yes, Sanctuary, yeah, more sort of like you get there's one sort of kind of kinky scene, but besides that, a lot more of it's just sort of talking in a room and veiled threats and things like that. But that was a riveting movie for me. I think that was probably underseen. I really, really liked that one. So yeah, aside from the ones that you mentioned that weren't in my top 10, that was kind of the only one that was on the cusp for me.
Yeah. Worst film?
Worst film? Eesh. That's really hard to say. I really did not like Origin. But I don't think that's a bad movie. It's just one that I did not necessarily like
Do you
the
see
its
that
format.
the official Origin Twitter account was like retweeting and all this stuff about how they weren't invited to the Oscar parties, and then
Oh,
they deactivated the account.
Yeah, I know there was
I'll
a
let me insert Artie Lang from Howard the Stern. Wah, but yeah,
I did
but
not care for Origin.
I liked it more than you, but it was a mixed film. I hated Wonka. I really don't like Wonka. That's one of the
Yeah.
worst things I
But
saw.
that's really, that's a Roald Dahl purist was a big part of that, right?
No, it's just it like one of my friends said, bring insulin. I just felt it was so icky, and just I just was
I
like
like that movie.
I really didn't like Saltburn. Did you ever see it
I
even?
did see it. I liked it quite a bit more than you did. It's not like one of my favorites of the year, and there was parts of it that I really thought were pretty distasteful, to be honest. But I did enjoy it in a kind of disgusting way.
But I
Like,
don't but to me, I don't we never actually reviewed it, did we?
no, we didn't.
I it didn't offend me or like really shock me that much. I just thought it, I just rolled my eyes, and I think
Yeah.
that in the movie I wish it had gone campier.
Further,
It
yeah.
well, no, I just wish that it takes itself too seriously, and I think that it acts like it's this, serious psychological thriller. And I'm like, no, you should have like the guy's like doing all this ridiculous stuff. Like it should have been like it, they should have leaned into it being like this is silly, and they take it too seriously.
It
And
took it like
I,
halfway, that approach, I think. It didn't
yeah.
fully lean into it.
But yeah, I really didn't like Saltburn, and yeah,
One of the
both,
most popular movies of the year, though, thanks to like the Amazon Prime push. So
yeah. I mean, there weren't too many movies I really disliked last year, but
no, me neither.
I think that there was a lot of good movies last year.
Yeah, I think this was kind of like the first year that felt like we had fully recovered from the shutdown of film production in 2020.
I really didn't like Evil Dead Rises. I really didn't
I
like
didn't
that.
care for that either. I thought that was a nasty movie.
Yeah, and I like nasty, but it wasn't the right nasty.
Yeah. It was some bad taste, I thought.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of really good ones. We had a decent amount of crossover in our top 10. And like you said, I think for the most part, the Oscars got it right. And even when the one I wanted to win didn't win, the one that did, I wasn't like, screw that. That's BS.
Like if I had all 100 plus movies I watched last year and I like did my top like one and two in every category, like if it wasn't number one, it probably was number two. Like in a lot of the category, like I would have voted for this over that. Like I was happy Poor Things won those technical awards. I would pretty much would have voted for those, and I was happy that Emma Stone won, and I was totally fine with Cillian Murphy winning. Sometimes there's things that like just weren't even eligible. Well, not that they weren't eligible, they didn't even make the shortlist. Like I don't know why Wiseman has never had a film
For best
nominated.
documentary.
And he finally was given an honorary Oscar a few years ago, but it's like crazy. It's like it won all the like critics awards for best documentary and didn't even make the short list.
Well, yeah. Well, there we
But
go.
anyway.
Killers of the Flower Moon, best picture of the year, according to the Movie Brats podcast, the only podcast that matters. So that got a nice kick out of
No.
Jonathan. So
We're one
thank
of many.
you. Yeah, one of many. So thank you for listening and enjoying the films of 2023 with us. Like we've said many times, that was a great year to be a moviegoer and a movie fan. And on our next episode, about a quarter into the year, we will be previewing our most anticipated movies of 2024. So we shut the book on 2023. Daylight savings has already happened. The days are growing longer. The year is well into full swing, but expect a preview of the 2024 movie slate in your podcast feeds very, very shortly. So thank you for listening, and we will be back with you next time.